You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today's the 27th of May, 2015, and today we are talking to Patrick Wood, a previous guest on The Corbett Report that you may remember. You may remember him from the August Forecast and Review, but he is also the author of a brand new book, available both in hard copy and as a Kindle download, called Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. That is available at technocracyrising.com. Patrick Wood, thank you so much for coming back on the program today.
My pleasure. Good to be with you again, James.
Excellent. Well, I am so glad to see you tackling this subject in particular, because for many years I've felt like a, if not a lone voice in the wilderness, at least a lonely voice in a vast expanse of alt media forest. But there aren't too many people covering this idea of technocracy, transhumanism, and all of the related subjects that go along with it. So my hat's off to you for covering this topic in a very thoroughly researched and documented book that I hope I will commend to the listeners' attention, and I hope they will check it out. But let's start in on this conversation by addressing the big topic, technocracy. What is technocracy? And obviously you lay out the history, you from the philosophical inception of this idea in the 18th, 19th centuries through its creation in the 20th century. But let's talk about a definition that comes from one branch of technocracy known as Technocracy Inc., that is cited in this book. You say, quote, or actually, the technocrats say, technocracy is the science of social engineering, the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population of this continent, North America. For the first time in human history, it will be done as a scientific, technical, engineering problem. Can you expand a little bit on that definition and this idea of technocracy and how it relates to people's lives today?
Oh, I sure can. You have to go back in history. Yeah, it's a broad question when you say let's apply it to our current day, but you have to go back in history and look at the original model for technocracy that was developed in the 1930s in particular. And there was an organization called Technocracy Inc. that was formed by a couple of people after they were booted from Columbia University. There was a brief stint where the technocracy movement was housed at Columbia. They got support from Columbia for, doing a couple of continental water studies and stuff. And many of the engineers and scientists that were part of technocracy were from Columbia University. Not all, but most. They got booted for a couple of reasons, mostly because the co-founder, Howard Scott, turned out to be disingenuous, kind of a promoter type, and he didn't represent himself correctly and didn't have the PhD that everybody assumed he had. And so Columbia didn't put up with that very long. They said, hey, man, you lied to us once, you're out of here. And so they started this organization called Technocracy Inc., and that's really where we see the main documentation now being that was created for the technocracy model that I believe is being implemented today in today's world. It was based on energy. They believed that capitalism was dead. It was right in the heat of the Great Depression. They thought that politicians were responsible for killing capitalism because, well, people are angry with politicians today too, right? So and what's going on? But they didn't have any use for politicians whatsoever. And the scientists and engineers at Columbia, and by the way, I'm not bashing all scientists and engineers. That's not the intent here. There were a few that bought into this at the time. They believed that because technology had come into society, that the very fabric of society had changed. And therefore, the politicians were unable to manage society because they didn't understand the technology. That was their reasoning, basically. So as a group, they stood up and says, if we don't step in as scientists and engineers and do something about this to save society from itself, society's going to crumble. And, World War II or World War III is going to, come about immediately, and the world's going to destroy itself. And you have to remember, too, this is all on the heels of World War I, which was really the first mechanized war that used technology in the history of the world. And it was appalling for everybody, especially for the scientists and engineers who took the blame for creating the technology that was used in World War One. So they had a guilt. They were suffering under a guilt trip right at that point. So they developed this energy-based economic model that was literally based on energy, not on price, not on supply and demand like traditional economics. And they believed that that they could use the scientific method to engineer society in a way that it would create a utopia, essentially. It was very much a utopian system. One evidence of that, by the way, just a quick evidence, is that the book by Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, was written in 1932, looking into the face of technocracy. So, you know, it was science fiction, granted. It's not doctrine, right? But
we do know that Aldous Huxley was very much tied in with the British scientific establishment and had been for generations in the Huxley family, part of that Darwin-Galton-Wedgwood family interbreeding mixture that that had formed the basis of the eugenics movement in the late 19th century in Britain.
So That's right.
At any rate, I think that is an interesting little connection. But let's focus a little bit on some of the philosophical background for this. And as I say, you go back in the book to the 18th and 19th centuries. But let's look at the early 20th century and someone named Frederick Taylor, who was part of the general progressivism movement that was taking place at the time and came up with something entitled Taylorism.
Yes.
What was Taylorism and how did that influence technocracy?
Taylor was a guy who invented the time and motion study that was used in factories back then to try and figure out how to make them more efficient. I don't know why somebody didn't think about it before, but you know that was his addition to management theory. And so he was very well known very quickly for his very astute observations on how to speed up the assembly line and get more production out of whatever it is people are making. Ford Motor Company was one of the first big examples of how Taylor management theory was applied to factory conditions, and he was in demand, and it was in demand all over the world. It spread like wildfire. But if you could sum up Taylorism in one thing, it was a discipline on how to squeeze more efficiency out of any kind of a economic machine. With the accent on efficiency.
Well, that's exactly right, and of course that played into this idea that there needs to be a managerial class looking over society, almost as a type of factory writ large. And I think this brings with it a host of ideological assumptions to do with holism, collectivism, the necessity of having strict management and regulation of processes. Talk about some of these philosophical ideas that come bundled up with the technocratic assumptions.
Wow. Yeah, there was a lot of things that came to bear on early technocracy. It really was all during the people were talking about it all during the 20s. And that was a time when all these philosophies were floating around. Many of them were brand new, like Taylorism, for instance, but they were floating around and people were grasping at different things and, you know, to kind of, I don't know, redefine society. And there was a competition going on, too, amongst thinkers to come up with the latest radical idea, you know, like, well, I can outdo that, you know, whatever. And, well, you think Marxism is good, why? You know, then they come up with some other crackpot idea that's, you know, supposed to be more radical. So you had a bunch of people that were active back in the teens and the 20s that were proposing different progressive ideologies. They didn't all make their way into technocracy, by the way, just as such, but it was a melting pot. And the idea of holism, for instance, since you mentioned holism, didn't have any direct connection with technocracy, but it influenced several of the people that were part of technocracy. And holism basically says that the units of organization of the world all answer to the next highest level of what they called a holon or the next unit. So a person has to give way to his family, a family needs to give way to the city block. The city block gives way to the district gives way to the city, city gives way to the state gives way to the federal government gives way to the world. all of these, all of the ideas of having to serve the greater good came from this theory of holism. And we hear that today everywhere. You need to serve, your actions need to be curtailed or corralled, if you will, to where you don't serve your selfish interests. Shame on you if you do. And you must think of the greater good here, whether it is, resource usage, the amount of water you use or the energy you use or whatever. These philosophies did make their way into the melting pot, at least. And out came, on the other side, technocracy popped out as a very well-defined economic system. You got to hand it to engineers and scientists for that. They know how to document stuff. They know how to explain it. And they did. They wrote books on it. They wrote papers on it. Their main technocracy Bible, if you will, was called Technocracy Study Course. It's available online. It's been scanned. You can go find that and read it if you want. But it was about a 350-page manual, explained everything you need to know about technocracy. They used it as an education tool all over the country. And by the way, there was over 500,000 original members of Technocracy Incorporated. It was a membership organization. Card-carrying members in the United States and Canada. It was big in Canada, by the way. Especially in British Columbia and
unfortunately so. Another shameful part of my Canadian heritage. Well, I think what you point out there is not only the holistic idea, of course, points at higher and higher levels of management, but that implies that there needs to be a top-down regulation and management of society. And in order to accomplish that, of course, we're talking about engineers and technocrats of various stripes here, who, of course, want to rigidly define, regulate, and control and micromanage all of these aspects of society. And just to give a hint of that, in the Technocracy Study Course, it lists 7 requirements for technocracy, and you note that the first 5 of those requirements are: register on a continuous 24-hour-per-day basis the total net conversion of energy, by means of the registration of energy converted and consumed, make possible a balanced load, provide a continuous inventory of all production and consumption, provide a specific registration of the type, kind, etc. of all goods and services produced and where used, and provide specific registration of the consumption of each individual, plus a record and description of the individual. So I think that gives at least a taste, a hint of how rigidly defined and regulated and controlled and micromanaged a technocratic society would be. And the interesting part about this is that list of items which they itemized there was not at all technologically feasible at the time that was written, and yet that is very much where we are at today with the types of technologies that are coming in to place. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about the development of the technologies that are enabling technocracy to come to fruition.
They would have had to use pen and paper, by and large, for most of this, but the interesting thing is one of the co-founders of Technocracy was M. King Hubbard, who was a young geophysicist at the time. Now, a geophysicist had no connection necessarily to the computer world, to the technology that would have been required to pull this off, yet he very succinctly wrote these requirements. And you say, how could a guy write something so specific and have no understanding of computer technology? Well, I can tell you I think we know what happened exactly. Columbia University had one building in those days. It was called Hamilton Hall. I think it's still there, but it's called Hamilton Hall. Hamilton Hall had a basement. It was a full footprint basement. The basement was used to house temporary projects. And that's where Technocracy, the movement, was housed during its tenure at Columbia University. That was a very impressionable time, for sure, for both Howard Scott and his co-founder, M. King Hubbard. It's believed very strongly, we can't exactly get pictures of it, but we believe very strongly that the other half of Hamilton Hall, the basement, had another temporary project that was being built by the forerunner of IBM. That's the original tabulator computing machine. And the the engineers and the scientists, those early data scientists that were working on that tabulator, would have had opportunity to have some very interesting discussions with the people from technocracy. Because remember, they were all still the same engineers and scientists that were at Columbia, right? So they're going to mix it up. You know they are. Have a little, you know, a few picnics in the summer or whatever, you know, and quaff a few beers and talk about the future. My guess is that M. King Hubbert got an education. He got schooled on what's going to happen in society. And other books and history books about the early days of IBM would indicate that they really did have a pretty good view of where it was headed. It just would take time. So now we have the technology to do the very things that are listed in these seven, in these six in particular, requirements, especially smart grid, with the installation of smart meters on the sides of homes and businesses to communicate with the, you know, devices, appliances inside the home and business to regulate the energy usage and so on. And what's even more concerning is that it's not just a North American format anymore. Not just North America. They used to just talk about North America primarily, Canada and the United States. But now it's global, because the global smart grid that's being created intends to take all of the energy data that's being used all around the world, rolling it up into a single point of collection, feeding into a computer to manage, literally to manage the energy of the world. This is incredible. The height of arrogance of these engineers was just astounding, by the way, James. They had this idea that they were going to take Canada, Mexico, and the United States. You can think North American Union there if you'd like. It would be okay. They were going to take these three countries plus the top, plus all of Central America, plus the top of South America, and they were going to create what they called a continental technate. That was going to be technocracy. That was their area of rule. What they never mention is, how are they going to talk Canada and just laying down and saying, oh, that's a great idea. And how are they going to get Mexico to just say, well, who cares about Mexico, man? We want to be part of the family. And what about all the, you know, these other countries? You can't just go out and tell countries, hey, well, we engineers have decided. Science says you need to be with us on this. You know, it's crazy. But now it's, as I said, it's morphed into a global conquest now, not just a continental conquest. But the technology is here now, and they're doing it. Bottom line, they are doing it.
Unfortunately, yes, that is exactly true. And as you say, this ties in very much to the smart grid technology and the Internet of Things and other things that are coming online now. But just before we move out of the early roots of the technocracy movement, let's talk a little bit more. You raised the specter of M. King Hubbert, who I'm sure is a character that some of the audience will be familiar with, or at least it will ring a bell, because, of course, this is the proponent of Hubbert's Peak, or the peak oil theory, which has become something that has very much been talked about in global geopolitics and oil geopolitics over the last few decades. Let's talk about M. King Hubbert's relation to technocracy and then his development of the peak oil theory. Are these two factors related?
I think they're very much related. M. King Hubbert left Technocracy, Inc. When he pursued a career in the secular world, outside of academia. He went to work for oil companies and stuff, and it didn't really suit him, I believe, to be part of this movement, you know, still be in the organization of Technocracy, Inc. And he was a co-founder, so he was an important figure. But I found no indication whatsoever that M. King Hubbert ever renounced technocracy. So it wasn't like a mad split. He just said, I've got other things to do with my life. And so he went off to do those other things. And it was 20 years after the founding of Technocracy in 1934, the incorporation, to 1954, when Hubbert wrote, when he proposed his theory of peak oil. And many some people call it peak oil theory. Others call it Hubbert's peak. By the way, Hubbert has no relation to Scientology. That's not the L. Ron Hubbard, A-R-D. It's a different spelling. You know, sometimes people think, oh, it's technology. They must be the same people. No, no, it's not the same. M. King Hubbert was he was a geophysicist, worked for oil companies, and he was pretty well known in his field for sure. But the peak oil theory was you could see, if you understood technocracy, you could see how he'd come up with this. It made perfect sense. Because they believed that resource shortage was the big problem back in the 30s, and that those resources had to be used more efficiently than they were being used in order for, you know, humanity to survive.
And like so many other aspects of technocratic rule, it requires that crisis in order to justify its own existence. And in some cases, I think there is the active wanting to bring about of these crises. So on that note, let's bring this forward closer to today, where, for example, you're talking about that early technocratic movement in Colombia with Scott and Hubbard, and you say that they believe that the actions of human beings, both direct and indirect, were the root cause of societal problems, and that they were directly related to biology, climate, and natural resources. The absence of enlightened scientific management would doom mankind to certain destruction. It is not coincidental that the most visible and manipulative modern agents of change, sustainable development, Agenda 21, global warming, the UN's green economy, and the modern ecology movement, etc., all hold to the same underlying assumptions. And just to back you up on that point, of course, we can turn to the Club of Rome's 1991 document, The First Global Revolution, where they wrote, "In searching for a common enemy against whom we can unite, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. In their totality and their interactions, these phenomena do constitute a common threat which must be confronted by everyone together. But in designating these dangers as the enemy, we fall into the trap, which we have already warned readers about, namely mistaking symptoms for causes. All these dangers are caused by human intervention in natural processes, and it is only through changed attitudes and behaviors that they can be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself." A pretty startling quotation, but one that seems to be exactly in line with the Technocracy Inc. Ideas. Let's talk about that and the implications of this modern form of the technocratic assumptions that were first hammered out in the 1930s.
Right. You know, there's a there's kind of a thought pattern that has been imprinted in the public psyche that technocracy merely means rule by experts. And in many cases in government, having an expert run a particular department is a good thing. You wouldn't want a dog catcher flying an airplane in the Air Force, for instance. You want to have somebody that knows what he's doing. So you can't just bash, you know, experts here or you know, but that's a very low-level definition of technocrat and technocracy. Technocracy as a replacement economic system is what's in view here. And that means that the total fabric of society must be changed. They call it transformation. It's a transformation process. Why I use that word in my subtitle of my book. The United Nations now calls that the ultimate process a deep transformation. That's a buzzword that only the UN will, you know, take credit for probably. But deep transformation means that the very fabric of society is intended to be changed. They're going to change it. It's not going to be anything that you and I grew up with or remember from 20, 30, 40 years ago. It's going to be a brand new, never tried before system that completely, radically transforms every little nook and cranny of society. It's transforming government into governance, management. It's transforming the economy. It's transforming religion. It's transforming the law, the legal system that's used to support it. Everything from top to bottom in our society is changing right under our nose. That's why people are feeling so much angst in the world today. like, what's going on? You know, what? Why are we all under so much stress? This is why, because there's two economic systems in the world fighting for supremacy. You can look at it like an MMA fight if you want. You know, they're in the ring. They're pounding each other as furiously as they can, trying to knock one or the other out. Except this is going to be a battle to the death. The seriousness of this cannot be understated. This is a sea change. This is not just a watershed. It's an absolute sea change that we've never seen in the history of the world. The climate change number one person at the United Nations is Christiana Figueres. Her official title is she's the executive secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. She's the big wheel as far as climate change is concerned at the United Nations. She was quoted in a press conference in early February, letting the cat out of the bag what sustainable development climate change is really all about. And she said, and I quote, "This is the first time in the history of mankind that we are setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution." Close quote. Now, you don't have to read between the lines too much there to figure out what she's saying. Capitalism is on the chopping block. They're going to kill it altogether. Now, I don't know why economists don't get excited about this. My background is in economics, and I get excited about it. Nobody else is paying attention to this, James. I cannot figure out why they wouldn't be at least curious to take somebody's statement like this and say, "What do you mean that you're going to change the economic development model? What are you going to change it into? What's it going to look like? How are we going to measure whether we're growing or not growing, or, you know, whether people are happy or not happy, whatever?" See, this never crosses these people's mind. When she makes a statement like this, it's like, oh, it's kind of like the original technocrats figured that Mexico, Canada, and the United States and all Central American countries somehow would just, "Oh, well, sure, that's a great idea, guys. We'll do that." It's like, excuse me? You have people in those countries that have a right to self-determination. You think you should ask them? What do they think about it? Do they want to go along with this program and be micromanaged from the top down? I'm sure most of them would say no. Not only no, they say, heck no. get out of my country. But here this woman is saying she's going to, you know, that the United Nations intends to murder capitalism and replace it with what they call their green economy, which I can assure you is nothing but warmed over technocracy from the 1930s. It's an energy-based economic system that would do away with capitalism and free enterprise altogether.
It is chilling to myself and others who have studied this history, but let me play devil's advocate for a moment and say, well, we know that the current system as it currently is functioning is malfunctioning, is dysfunctioning. What we saw in 2008 is just a taste of what is likely to come with the coming economic crises based on the capitalist system that we have in place now. It's capitalism that brought us to this place, Patrick, of course. So what would you say to those people who would say, well, we do need a different system, and why not have one that is run by experts? That seems to make more intuitive sense to a lot of people.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of people are saying that today, especially in Europe. They, you know, they don't care over there anymore. They've just given up on having, you know, sovereignty. So, you know, having sovereign nations say, well, whoever can straighten us out, we welcome the help. But the people who have manipulated our economic system in the last 40 years, i.e. members of the Trilateral Commission in particular. That was the group that was founded with members from Japan and North America and from Europe. It's now a little bit broader than that. There's about 390 members today, and you have some Asia, some Asians, some North African members, and other countries are involved now too. But the Trilateral Commission set about to create a new international economic order back in 1973. I'll just use that as an example. These people have single-handedly manipulated and gamed the capitalistic system for their own benefit and to screw everybody else. Excuse the, you know, the vernacular. But that was their goal. It was John D. Rockefeller himself. That was the original Rockefeller way back in the early 1900s who said capitalism is a, competition is a sin. Don't want any competition. We just want to do and have a monopoly on it and charge whatever the heck we want to charge. This is a bad mentality to have on people that want to run the world, because that means you and I are not going to get a chance, you know, to do anything. So free enterprise has always been the stalwart of small business in America. It's where ideas come from. It's where people get employed. 80% of employment comes from small businesses in America. And, you know, when government stays out of economic matters, generally speaking, business people are happy, employees are happy, and customers are happy. When government gets involved and starts, you know, mousing with the whole system, or when an outside agent comes in, like the Trilateral Commission came in and took over our economic machinery in America, these people turned everything upside down, and we got the short end of the stick. I can't blame capitalism for that. I can blame these greedy, paternalistic profit mongers, if you will, who thought that they knew better than anybody else on how to structure the world, and thank you very much, get out of the way while we do it. You know, we do have the PhDs after all, and we know what we understand stuff here. You don't. And everybody just bought into it. I could point to things like the North American Free Trade Agreement. They promised the moon when that was first being passed. Oh, it's going to be great. Oh, we're going to have jobs. We're going to have, you know, new factories are going to move here. We're going to have prosperity, and everybody's, you know, the whole sea's going to rise. Everybody's going to rise with it. Ross Perot said at the time, no, what you're going to hear is that giant sucking sound going south. Okay, which did we hear? Did we get the promise or did we get the curse? We got the curse. You know, NAFTA was engineered by members of the Trilateral Commission completely. It was their baby from start to finish. So, you know, these people have been doing it to us and hosing us. Capitalism has taken a bum rap because of these people. It's getting the blame. It's kind of like people in South America that hate gringos, you know, they hate us. You say, well, wait a minute. What, you know, I'm just a person. Do you hate me personally? But they look at the United States mostly as the people who have plundered their country. And they blame the whole country for it. But was it the whole country? No. It was just a few people, some of whom happen to be from America.
Exactly right. And I think it's important to differentiate the crony capitalist system, which has arisen specifically in the last centuries from actual capitalism. Yeah. And also, of course, I mean, the fundamental problem, I know that you tend to differentiate, and I've heard you in other interviews differentiate technocracy from socialism or fascism as more political movements, whereas technocracy is more of an economic theory. But I would say that they do converge at various points, including in the idea of a command and control economy. And I think in that way they fail on the same point, because the command and control economy is based on the fundamental flaw of the economic calculation problem, which cannot be solved under a labor theory of value, as socialists would put it, or an energy theory of value, as technocrats would put it. It can only be understood and explained under the subjective theory of value. I think there's fundamental economic problems with technocracy. But the point of all of this, I think, is who would be at the top of this pyramid? Who would be the experts, the self-appointed experts to look over this system? And I think the self-evident answer is the very people that you identify, for example, in the Trilateral Commission. And I know that you and Anthony Sutton did pioneering work on the Trilateral Commission decades ago, talking about the creation of this group and what they've managed to accomplish. And you detail that quite a lot in this book. In fact, every Trilateral Commission member in the book is in bold type so that we know that they are a trilateral connected figure. Tell us a little bit more about the Trilateral Commission and how it oversees this process.
Well, the Trilateral Commission, as I mentioned, was started in 1973 by David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski. And Brzezinski's book, Between Two Ages, I believe is what really brought Rockefeller to the table to, well, at least to pick up Brzezinski as a co-founder of the Trilateral Commission. The subtitle on his book was America's Role in the Technotronic Era. I found out just after I started studying technology that what he meant by the technotronic era was essentially technocracy. It's what we have today. You have to go back and read the book to find that out. But when they got into operation, the first thing they did was to put forth a presidential candidate. That was, of course, remember, they had all the money in the world to put at it, too, with Rockefeller and everybody else around him. They picked up Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale as vice presidential candidate, got him elected in 1976, the pair of them. Carter then proceeded to sweep into office one-third of the membership of the American members of the Trilateral Commission into his top cabinet positions, and a lot of them went into the State Department, too. that was an incredible feat. But it wasn't a political coup in my mind. They said that back in those days. Oh no, we're not interested in politics. Well, I really don't think they were. They wanted to get their hands on the economic machinery of the world. And they did that by capturing the United States executive branch. They didn't care about Congress, they didn't care about the judiciary. They only cared about the engine of economic prosperity, if you will, and that was our government. And so the first U.S. trade representative that was appointed to negotiate trade treaties for the president was a member of the Trilateral Commission. In fact, ever since then, there have been 12 different members or 12 different USTRs that have been appointed by the president along the way. That's over a period of long time. 9 of those 12 have been members of the Trilateral Commission. What can you say to that other than the fact that, well, it tells you what they were after. They wanted to be in a position to have their man negotiating these treaties like NAFTA and CAFTA and the TPP. The current USTR, Michael Froman, who's putting together the Trans-Pacific Partnership and also the Transatlantic coming right behind it, this guy's a member of the Trilateral Commission. When does this stuff stop, you see? Then you have the situation with the World Bank. The president of the World Bank is always appointed by our president. That's how it's set up at Bretton Woods. Europe gets to pick the IMF head. And so they always pick that. But there have been 8 members of the 8 appointees to World Bank since Jimmy Carter. 6 of those have been members of the Trilateral Commission. Now you say, well, what's the big deal with the World Bank? Well, the World Bank has been the major engine of globalization around the world. They had it in their pocket the whole time. You just have to ask the question, okay, they own that position. They own the World Bank. They own the USTR. They own the executive branch, lock, stock, and barrel by and large. Are they looking out after American interests? You know, like just us in America or people in Canada or whatever? I mean, you know, are they looking after our family and even a North American continent? No, they're negotiating for themselves. And what are their goals? Well, they said originally to create a new international economic order. So we see these people everywhere. When we look at the 1992 Rio conference that started Agenda 21, that started sustainable development as a doctrine, that was preceded by a 1987 book called Our Common Future. The United Nations now says, if it wasn't for that book, the Rio conference in 92 never would have taken place. They just say it. This is the one. The woman that chaired the committee, the United Nations committee, called the Brundtland Commission. Gro Harlem Brundtland was the chairman of that group. She is the principal author of the book, Our Common Future. She's the principal architect, therefore, of Agenda 21, Sustainable Development. The book is still in print. You can buy it and get it. But Gro Brundtland was a member of the Trilateral Commission from Europe. Who did she write that book for? For the good of the world or for the good of the Trilateral Commission? I would suggest the latter. Of course, they've had control of the economic engine from the get-go, and they still do. They're still using the same, you know, the same worn-out techniques to drive the world towards technocracy today. It's incredible. John Podesta, I have to bring this up. I didn't mention John Podesta in my book, but if I do a revision, I'm going to. John Podesta came from the United Nations. He's a member of the Trilateral Commission. Went to work for President Obama as a senior policy advisor in charge of climate change. The New York Times last November wrote an article about Podesta. Now, they're not, you know, they're not the most conservative newspaper in the world, believe me. The New York Times claimed that John Podesta single-handedly created the president's climate change policy. He created the executive orders that he was going to sign to implement those changes in the executive branch of our government. And just recently, he left the employ of Obama and went to work as campaign manager for Hillary Clinton. So he's kind of out of the picture right now. But here's a guy who sweeps in from the United Nations, coming off of a high-level panel of experts or esteemed persons, and jets right into President Obama to give him all of this doctrine, if you will, the plan. Did Obama come up with this? No. Did Congress come up with this? No. Did a think tank in the United, you know, was it the Rand Corporation? Ha. Or was it, you know, some other organization? Maybe it's the Council on Foreign Relations. You wish. No, it was a direct intravenous application of of trilateral style globalism by a member of the Trilateral Commission. What can you say? It's just incredulous.
It shouldn't be surprising at this point, I guess, certainly over the last five decades, whatever it is now of this type of influence, which I agree is pervasive and ongoing. However, I would say that the Trilateral Commission obviously is one of these key groups, but I think it is only one in an interlocking network of groups, including, for example, the Royal Institute for International Affairs / Council on Foreign Relations / a number of other groups that were birthed out of the Rhodes Roundtable at the end of the First World War, or the Bilderberg group formed in the early 1950s that was influential in the creation of the European Union, etc. I think the membership of these groups is often multiple. There's usually trilateral / Bilderberg / CFR members / other groups. And I see no reason to give any particular primary importance to the Trilateral Commission, but I'm open to being persuaded otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason I give them credit is that I do is because they were the first international action committee that had, they had a plan. They were created around a plan to create a new international economic order. That's what they said back then. Their scholars at the time had written and confessed that their attempts previously had failed. They had the thoughts. It's not that they didn't want to, you know, they knew what they wanted to do, but they had not been successful in getting it done. The Trilateral Commission was the answer to that. That's what they pushed forward. And so when Brzezinski and Rockefeller went to Europe in 1972 to the Bilderberg meeting, they bounced the idea of the Trilateral Commission off their cronies at Bilderberg. Well, Bilderberg is, they're a very influential organization, obviously. I'll say that. They are. They always have important people to go to it. But they don't have an official static membership list. They don't have an action plan, nor do they have the means to even carry out an action plan. If they did, they're just important people that get together and discuss their own, you know, whatever, with their axes at the grind. And that's what happened when the Trilateral Commission was formed. They went over there, hey, guys, what do you think about this? Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Why don't you go do that? And, of course, many members of the Bilderberg group were picked as the initial contingent of the Trilateral Commission. There was overlap with the CFR in North America. There was overlap with the Atlantic Council in Europe. There was overlap with the smaller membership of the Club of Rome. And there were other organizations that you could look at that you could say, well, there's a high concentration of Trilateral Commission members in that organization. And, you know, there's obviously they're not all alone in this. They're not the only ones that are doing this, but they are the drivers. They're the policymakers. They're the ones that got into government positions like in our country with Jimmy Carter and with Walter Mondale. They literally took over the executive branch of our nation in 1976. It's never been the same since. So, you know, no other group has exercised this kind of hegemony. that they've exercised over America. The only administration that has not had at least one member in the executive branch, president or vice president, is the current one with Obama and Biden. They're not members. They are surrounded with members, however, like the National Security Advisor, the Director of National Intelligence, several in the State Department. So they still stack on the deck, but this is the first administration where either the president or vice president was not a member. Everything before, Clinton and Al Gore, both members. George H.W. Bush, a member. Dick Cheney, with George W. Bush, a member.
It's almost like Democrats and Republicans don't really matter.
They don't.
Who would have thought it?
They don't.
They certainly don't matter at all.
It's completely above that plane. It's so far above that plane, it's amazing that they can even look down and see the dots of the little ants on the planet.
Yes, it reminds you of Harry Lime in The Third Man, looking down at the little ants scurrying below. And what do you care if one of them dies? Interesting. Well, let's raise one other objection then that I'm sure people will likely have as part of their indoctrination in our current, steeped in our current milieu, which is that, oh, well, we're talking about Agenda 21, sustainability, green economy. These are wonderful things because they're about protecting the planet, protecting the Earth. And these are things that we want. Why are you talking about them disparagingly, Patrick?
Well, I care about the planet too. I grew up on a farm, California. My parents were very meticulous about caring for their own property, and the farmers in the area that I knew were very meticulous as well. They had agricultural practices that have been completely lost today, unfortunately. But I grew up with an idea that, you know, taking care of nature was a good thing to do. But when you extend the natural instinct of people wanting to take care of nature, you know, take care of our environment. I don't like dirty air any more than anybody else. But when you extend that to the idea of completely replacing capitalism, which would destroy the fabric of our nation altogether, it would destroy national sovereignty, not just our nation, but, you know, Canada, Mexico, and everybody else. It would destroy those things that we have based our civilization on for the last at least 2,000 years. This is not warranted. This is undue influence. This is what I'm warning about. It's not merely just, hey, it's all about the environment. No, it's not. Christiana Figueres was clear about that in her press conference. I don't, you know, she might have got slapped for saying what she said. If I was her boss, I would have said, shut up. You shouldn't be saying things like that. You let people like Pat Wood hear that, he gets all excited. But the whole goal of climate change and environmentalism and sustainable development is not just about protecting the ecology. It's about control over the human race. That's what scares me. And she just as much said it.
Exactly right. I mean, I hope this main idea is getting through to people, that this is fundamentally about micromanagement of every aspect of people's lives. And as we talked about earlier, the technology for doing that is now actually here. And we have politicians, like politicians in the UK a few years ago, talking about the idea of assigning people carbon ration cards that will have a certain amount of carbon credits. Once you're topped up with your carbon credits, you don't get any more energy for the rest of the month. And if you freeze to death, well, so be it. This is now actual serious political proposals that are coming on the table and are now technologically impossible, technologically possible, being enabled by smart grid technologies and all of these other things, which it should be frightening to people who understand that people who want to control society are the ones that are putting themselves in these positions of expert status to tell everyone what to do. So this is a very important topic. We haven't obviously done justice to it in the short conversation we've had, but I will once again exhort people to go to technocracyrising.com to take a look at the book. And it's exhaustively documented. It's very thorough. It covers all of these aspects of technocracy and more. But one other thing I wanted to get into before we wrapped up this conversation was the idea that it flabbergasts me, it boggles my mind, but now, in this current day and age, 2015, we have people who are once again coming along with this resource-based economy idea as if it's a new idea and are now trying to perpetuate it. And it seems that the credulity of the resource-based economy proponents is in a direct correlation with their ignorance of the history of technocracy. What can you say about this re-rise of this resource-based economy idea and its proponents in the current day and age?
They're ignorant for sure. Well, most of them will be ignorant, some aren't, but it's definitely a little bit disingenuous to, you know, to claim that it's your idea and it's never happened before. And it's not just one movement. There actually are several splinters of utopianism where, you know, resource-based economy, whether it's, and you pick the resource, okay, whether it's energy or some other resource, coal or whatever. this is just not a new idea. And if technocracy originally had not documented itself so well, you could argue that point, you know, argue against it. Well, no, this is new. But you know what? The technocracy study course was so absolutely definitive. You just got to go back and read it. It's all there. Unfortunately, I had to read it one time. I got the biggest Excedrin headache I ever had in my life. But, you know, people could go read that stuff and say, okay, now wiggle out of this one, would you? You know, tell me how you're different. It's exactly the same stuff.
It's sad, unfortunately, that the same things, the same ideas keep getting regurgitated and keep getting all these followers. I mean, the same 500,000 people who signed up for Technocracy Inc. are the same types that will be signing up for this new iteration of the same old idea. So every generation, I think, has to fight the same fight, unfortunately. And as we move closer to the technological implementation of this, that fight becomes more and more important, which is why I'm glad that there are more voices that are talking about this and that your voice has been added to that mix. Finally, before we wrap up today, I would be remiss in my hosting duties if I did not take a moment to ask your thoughts on a somewhat unrelated matter, which is you're obviously, for people who don't know, you were a co-author, a colleague with Anthony Sutton, who I've mentioned many, many, many times on this program. I've gone back to his research on the rise of on Wall Street and the rise of Hitler, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, all of these really important studies that he did. And I have noted that in the 1980s, he was predicting that by the year 2000, China would be the new rising world superpower on the back of American technology and economic help. And lo and behold, here we are in the age of the rising China and the growing China-US rivalry. What do you think? This is a horrible question to put to you and put you on the spot, so I will try to rephrase it. I was going to say, what do you think Anthony Sutton would say about that development? But perhaps, what do you say about your own?
I know what he would say. We had this pretty well figured out back then. It was Henry Kissinger, when he was working for Richard Nixon, who made the first illegal trip to China to start negotiating an economic softening, a thaw. A lot of people thought Kissinger should have been put in jail. He should have been tried for treason at that point, because China was a sworn enemy of the United States. Kissinger is one of the early members of the Trilateral Commission, by the way, 1973. Then Zbigniew Brzezinski, the co-founder of the Trilateral Commission, finished the normalization process under Jimmy Carter completely. I've got pictures to prove it. And, you know, we knew that back then. We saw what was going on. These people were opening up China as a private preserve for their economic exploitation. They were the ones that sent the companies in to build up the infrastructure before it was even conceivably legal for an American company to set foot in China. Bechtel Engineering had already conducted 18 major infrastructure projects in China. Bechtel Engineering is the largest private engineering company in the world at the time, it probably still is, and Bechtel Engineering was headed by a member of the Trilateral Commission. So this is the way these people worked. They set the deal up, they send their own people in. Who made all the money off of China initially? Mostly members of the Trilateral Commission, their companies. Who invested all the money to build up the infrastructure in China? Same people. They're the ones that went in front of the money for it, you know? So you look at China today, it's literally raped our country, and people are upset about it for all kinds of different reasons. You look at it today and say, who is responsible for China? I can tell you who. Members of the Trilateral Commission, period, end of subject. They did it. They did it. And they benefited most from it.
And continue to do so, as even as they ramp up the Cold War rhetoric and all of this nonsense that's going on right now. Well, I keep wishing that Anthony Sutton was around to write Wall Street and the Rise of China, but I guess we should stop wishing, and perhaps I should do that myself.
That's a good topic. I'm gonna think about
that. Oh, no, I've given it to you. Well, I will suggest China and the New World Order, a podcast episode that I had late last year as a starting point for that research, but there's a lot more to do, so I will be doing more work on it as well. It's an extremely important topic right now. Anyway, this has been another fascinating conversation. So, Patrick Wood, let's not leave it so long till the next conversation. But once again, thank you for taking the time to join us. As I mentioned, technocracyrising.com is the website for the book specifically. Give us the August forecast and review website.
Yes, augustforecast.com is my blog site where my, you know, trends, economic forecasts, and so on is. And the book's available at Amazon as well, and there's a Kindle version if people like e-readers. That's fine, too. I just hope they get and read it.
I hope so, too. And let's leave it there for today. Patrick Wood, thank you again for your time.
Thank you, James. It's been a pleasure.